He is the last of the witch diggers, they said. Susan was telling a passing farmer how strange women with long faces and arms glided up to the shanty and peered through the windows. How monkeys with human heads entered the door and upset the tables and chairs. He is the last of the witch diggers, they said.
Welcome to Strange Familiars Podcast. We cover a range of topics from the paranormal to cryptids to the occult to mythology and folklore. Some of our shows will be presented over multiple episodes, while others will be one-shot features. We do our best to put out new shows every other week. I'm Timothy Renner.
And I'm Anthony Hoskin. Please make sure to like and subscribe to us wherever you are listening. YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, or via any other service you use to get your podcasts. If you could give us a like, a comment, share us around on social media, that all helps get us seen.
Yeah, we're trying to get in front of more people, so spread the word if you can.
And if you have an idea for any strange stories you would like us to cover, or if you've experienced something strange yourself, please contact us by email at strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars.
And if you like what we're doing, please consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/strangefamiliars. We have lots of different subscriber levels for things like buttons, vinyl stickers, t-shirts, signed copies of our book, you name it. But even at $3 a month, you can get bonus content. We're doing patron-only episodes. We've released one so far. We're working on the second right now. You can get all the previously released patron episodes and anything new we do as well.
That's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. Every little bit helps, and we thank the patrons who have already signed up.
The more patrons we have, the more content we can make, both in terms of the regular show and the bonus episodes. So thanks again to the patrons, and stay tuned for more. So, the Witch Diggers. I have to say,
That's the coolest name for any episode, I think.
Yeah, Sharon, just people knowing nothing about the episode, just kind of telling people it was coming up. Like the Where Does the Road Go crew, I was talking to them about it. They were very excited on name alone. Oh, I can't wait for that one.
Yeah.
Of course, Joshua knows what it's about, but the rest of the crew was kind of like, just on name alone, I could tell they were excited to hear it.
And it was very cool talking with Joshua, by the way. That was a very great segment that we did that you'll hear coming up here.
Yeah, I think Joshua knocked it out of the park.
Certainly.
As per usual. I stumbled on this story when I was doing research for my upcoming book, which is called Bigfoot in Pennsylvania. This story was in a Pennsylvania paper, but it didn't take place in Pennsylvania. It's in Indiana. So I wasn't going to use it in the book, but it was really interesting. I just saw it, and I was like, wow, this is a really interesting story. And in fact, this may become part of, if not a whole other book, by the time I'm done digging into it. Super interesting. Lots of stuff going on.
The Witch Diggers, a story of their strange monomania. Old Nick still lives, one of the ill-fated Bishlers at large. Delusions drove them mad. Frank Rose, a farmer boy residing in the southeastern part of Jennings County, Indiana, visited a rosy-cheeked neighbor last Sunday evening. It was nearly midnight when he started on his return over stony hills and hollows. Though he was a bold youth, he became silent as he approached the lonely valley known as Rocky Ravine. When halfway through the tortuous cleft between the hills, a slight sound attracted his attention. On his right, near the top of the hillside, a curious figure was seen creeping from rock to rock and keeping well in the shadows. It carried something which gleamed brightly now and then as the moon's rays fell upon it. It came nearer and nearer the farmer, who had crouched down behind a clump of blackberry bushes, with a strange feeling of dread within him. The mysterious being, animal or man, approached until it reached the roadway within 10 feet of the boy, when with a bound it sprang up to the top of a huge boulder, where it crouched for a moment in the full glare of the moon. Frank Rose gave one look back and then shut his eyes with a gasp of horror. The thing upon the rock was a man. But what a man! When Frank got home that night, he told a wonderful story of a vision he had seen upon the way of a creature which, though it walked on all fours and was covered with hair from head to foot, carried a gleaming axe and displayed other indications of being human. It was gaunt but muscular and had burning eyes that shone through long, tangled locks of hair. He had seen this thing but for a moment as it crouched upon a rock. Then it leaped down on the other side, and he made his way out of the deserted valley as quickly as possible. Young Rose's story created little agitation among the neighbors. They practically pooh-poohed it. The superstitious added it to their list of ghost tales, and inwardly resolved never again to be caught in the neighborhood of Rocky Ravine after nightfall. But the adventure was not to end so lightly. On the very next night, Monday evening, Henry Simon and William Downey, stock buyers, living in another county, rode within a short distance of the dreary valley, when they were astonished to hear the reverberation of a succession of blows, evidently made by some instrument of steel or iron. They tied their horses and walked up the dark ravine, until they arrived at a tremendous cavity which had evidently been excavated by human hands. 20 feet below, in the darkness, someone was striking blow after blow upon the rocky bottom of the pit. "What are you doing down there?" shouted Simon. For an answer, a stone came whizzing through the air, narrowly missing Downey's head. A big, hairy creature sprang out of the hole with a frightful yell, and disappeared with surprising rapidity over the side of the hill, still carrying its steel tool, though running apparently on 4 legs. The traders were stupefied with astonishment, and lost no time in getting out of the neighborhood. Their story, as related to several residents of the vicinity, taken with that of the boy Rose, created much excitement, and during the week more than one man paid a visit to Rocky Ravine, several being satisfied with a glimpse at the wild man who was now believed to inhabit it. There was little difficulty in establishing his probable identity, as the county round had not yet recovered from the agitation caused by the almost incredible actions of a family which formerly resided at the mouth of the ravine. When a special correspondent visited the place yesterday to investigate the strange stories concerning it, there was but one belief among the people regarding the strange being of the valley. "He is the last of the witch diggers," they said. The history of the witch diggers is so remarkable as to be almost beyond belief. It is the story of a peculiar monomania that affected one by one an entire family until all were subjects for the insane asylum. The family was made up originally of hard-headed, practical people and included three brothers who fought bravely in the Union Army during the Civil War. A surprising feature of the entire affair is that, although it attracted widespread attention locally for weeks, and although thousands of people visited Rocky Ravine to witness the remarkable conduct of its residents, nothing of the Witch Diggers has reached the public ear until now. This fact is partly accounted for by the location of the tragic events to be described below, a country as wild as any to be found in Indiana, although not many miles away from North Vernon, a thriving railroad center, and the cultured and beautiful seat of Jennings County. The sterile, stony country surrounding Rocky Ravine belongs to a section of Hoosierdom that has been the home of crime and tragedy for many years, which has hidden in its unfruitful bosom many dark secrets of the past. Here it was that the organized bands of horse thieves of southern Indiana had their gloomy retreats and passed their living booty from station to station among the hills south of the winding Muscatatuck. Here it is that white-capping was introduced as the only cure for prevailing lawlessness, and where it was afterward abused until the white-caps became almost as much an object of public odium as their victims. Here many things could and do occur that would shock or interest the public, but which are never heard behind the confines of the dark country. This explains the general ignorance concerning the Witch Diggers, whose history is as interesting as it is remarkable. The Bischler parents were honest, uncultured Swiss, who came from the canton of Bern to this country many years ago. They brought with them two children, John and Susie, and others were born as the family moved westward and finally located on a farm 3 miles from Damascus, Columbiana County, Ohio. When the war broke out, three sons went away to fight for the Union, John and Steve in the 65th Ohio Infantry, and Nick in the 115th Ohio Volunteers. Steve was only a boy of 14 and was killed at the Battle of Franklin. John was drowned in the Mississippi, while Nick, who had just reached his majority, came back alone to the farm in Ohio. The parents died soon after, and Nick became the protector of his elder sister Susan, still unmarried and likely to remain so, and a brother, Sammy, who had never been burdened with any alarming amount of gray tissue. The three lived together, cultivating the little farm, in making a comfortable subsistence until the spirit of unrest, which had been bred in Nick Bischler by his war experience, led him to sell the old homestead and move to Indiana. He bought a farm of 40 acres, hilly, stony, and marked with deep chasms and ravines, which lay about 4 miles southwest of Butlerville, a small station on the O&M Railroad. This was 10 years or more ago, and the Bischlers soon became known among the country folks as honest, hard-working people, a type of the respectable lower classes of Europe. Nick was a fine-looking man of middle age, with a sturdy form and bright blue eyes that contrasted well with his black hair. His heavy mustache and military air made him an object of admiration among the fair sex, but he never paid attention to the damsels of the neighborhood, seeming content to work day after day along with his sister and simple-minded brother. As for Susan, she was never in question as a marriageable quantity. She was an eerie creature, looking just a witch herself, with her great staring great eyes, hawkbill nose, and capacious mouth, the only visible teeth of which were two false ones that were continually making their presence known by protruding beyond the shriveled lips of their wearer. Sammy was a small, dark man who rarely talked, except to repeat what someone else had said. The farm occupied by the Bischlers was a lonely place, lying some distance off the road, and with no neighboring homes near the little frame shanty where the trio lived. About a quarter of a mile away from the house was a deep rocky cleft between high hills, which was known as Rocky Ravine. The narrow zigzag valley was a gloomy enough place, even in the daytime, and some ugly stories were told about it, but they were for the most part vague and ill-founded. Such was the Bischler family when they first came to the neighborhood, and for years afterward. The curious hallucination, which wrecked the minds of an entire family and set them upon the care of the world, was first manifested in Sammy, the youngest of the trio. One day Sammy was left alone in the solitary cabin, and when Nick returned he found the poor fellow crouched down beneath the bed, staring immovably at one of the small windows of the structure. He had seen something awful. This much was obtained from him by much questioning, though Sammy, as a rule, confined his conversational efforts to a repetition of some other person's remarks. Something had come in through the window, but what it was, and what it did, or what it became, were questions that Sammy never answered, save in the vaguest possible manner. He soon ceased to talk about the matter, but it was noticed that he would never remain alone in the house again. He had no liking for the farm either, particularly avoiding the shadowy depth of Rocky Ravine, and he was often seen walking alone miles away from the dreary fields that were his home. Conversation with Sammy was never very enjoyable, and when in a sullen mood, as he was almost all the time now, he could not be induced to open his mouth, even to reply to a simple salutation. The neighboring farmers paid little note to his eccentricities, but would say, "Poor Sammy, he never was very smart. He's clean daft now." Months passed, and just as twilight was falling, after a hot summer day, the uncanny form of Susan Bischler was seen at the residence of Thomas Spencer, a well-to-do farmer, who was the nearest neighbor of the Swiss family. Her big eyes were wilder in appearance than ever before, while her shrunken form was trembling with excitement. "What is it, Susan?" asked Mr. Spencer. "Te have zot Nick," she whispered, looking about her fearfully before replying. "They? Who?" "Te witches." "What did they do with them?" inquired Mr. Spencer, who was somewhat puzzled by the woman's manner. "I don't know. Tay come in through a window like monkeys, and take poor Nick and choke him. Then I throw something at him, and tay gave after me, and I run over here. Oh, poor Nick, tay have got him, I'm afraid." While Susan was still talking, Nick came plodding up to the gate in his heavy boots, showing no indications of having had any difficulty with the witches. He took his elder sister by the arm and started away without a word. "Susan has seen some witches," said the neighbor. "She was dreaming," replied Big Nick gruffly, as he proceeded homeward, half-dragging the woman with him, despite her protestations of fear. He was right. Susan had been dreaming, but it was a dream which he was fated to share before many weeks. Whether his sturdy common sense was not proof against the weirdness of his surroundings, or whether the belief in witches was a monomania that was born in the Bischlers, is a question that may puzzle the wisest heads. Certain it is that Nick, the strongest of the trio in mind and body, himself fell a victim to the same superstitions that had worked such havoc in the minds of his relatives. The fact was first discovered while Susan was telling a passing farmer how strange women with long faces and arms, hatless and barefoot, glided up to the shanty and peered through the windows, how monkeys with human heads entered the door and upset the tables and chairs, how monstrous snakes crawled into the little yard and spat great wads of venom at the weather-beaten boards of the cabin, and how a thousand other inexplicable events were taking place night and day on the poor little 40-acre farm where the Bischlers were trying so hard to make a living. "All vitches," repeated Susan in her dismal, whining voice. "To women, to monkeys, to snakes, everything. All vitches." "Why don't you tell your sister that she's mistaken, Nick?" asked the farmer impatiently. "Maybe she's right," returned Nick gloomily as he strode away. It was not long before the superstition of the Bischlers was productive of astonishing and even dangerous results. The phases of the disease, which finally drove every one of them stark mad on the subject of witches, cannot be described, as their farm lay off the highways, and no one cared to visit the house whose own residence had given it anything but a good name. Susan, now a veritable old hag with flaming eyes in which no spark of reason shone, came to a neighbor's house at long intervals, always gibbering about the vitches which infested her home. Sammy wandered about as usual, but nothing could induce him to speak. Big Nick was seldom seen, and then but for a moment, as he hastened on his way over the hills he called his own. Nick seemed to be always in a hurry now. He was thinner, too, and his lowering brow was wrinkled with some trouble, of which he spoke to no one. Indeed, he avoided everybody outside of his own family, and his surly replies to civil interrogations soon gave him the solitude he desired, for Nick was powerful, and his eyes glittered with an unnatural, dangerous light at times. A hunter was toiling along the rough slope of one of the hills that encircles Rocky Ravine one day, when he saw two men working in the bottom of the chasm. The larger of the two was wielding an axe with tremendous vigor, while the other was using a shovel with untiring energy. Nearby, sitting on a rock, was a woman who was watching the laboring men with intense interest. For the life of him, to use his own expression, the hunter couldn't see what the men were working at, and he stumbled down the hill to satisfy his curiosity in this respect. His coming was unnoticed by the three people below. The men kept on working as if their lives depended on it, while the woman's eye never left them. The axe was falling on rock, and now and then the men would lift a great slab from the bottom of the hollow and carry it out of the cavity, which was 10 or 12 feet deep. The hunter became more curious than ever, and after repeated questioning, the woman turned and said, "Te vitches are under the rocks." The three Bischlers now had but one thought, one occupation. Their days and nights were spent in hunting witches. The frame shanty was deserted, or rather surrendered, to the eerie enemies of the family. The two brothers and the sister remained in Rocky Ravine all the time, waging furious war against the witches. Nick somehow became impressed with the belief that the Stony Valley was the chief home of the unfriendly spirits, and as he was the leading spirit of the trio, the Bischlers remained constantly in the chasm, sleeping but little, and then on the bare rocks. The farm was entirely neglected. A calf died of starvation. The Bischlers said the witches had killed it. A horse went the way of all earthly beings. The Bischlers killed all their cattle for fear they would breed more witches. A half-starved hen made its way to the ravine in search of food. The Bischlers set upon it with axe and club and hung the mangled remains to a tree as a warning to the other witches. A big green frog happened to leap into the hole where the men were working. They beat and chopped it into 1,000 bits, and added the few pieces of it that could be found to their trophies. Susan gathered a wagon load of switches, and with these the Bischlers occasionally massacred a witch in the shape of a luckless bird, a butterfly, a snake, or a bug. They kept tab on all of the slain witches by sticking pegs in the earth on a level spot a few yards from the seat of their labors, and here, after a successful battle with the common enemy, the three lunatics would gather, dancing around the sticks and screaming with laughter. They even sang of their triumphs at times, a monotonous chant, telling of the number killed, and threatening more dire results in the next engagement. Their trophies of victory increased until they had a large collection made up of the carcasses of birds and beasts and many inanimate objects. These relics would have been laughable had it not been for the terrible earnestness of the people who had gathered them. For 3 weeks the Bischlers lived in the ravine, working with frenzied energy and hardly stopping even to eat. The story of the hunter was soon noised about, and crowds of people came to witness the work of the witch diggers. Strange to say, no effort was made to check the deluded wretches from their fruitless labors, although they were rapidly approaching the stage of utter exhaustion. During this period, the Bischler boys, with only one axe, a pick, and a shovel for tools, dug a trench 75 feet in length and from 15 to 25 feet deep down through the rocks, which have but a shallow coating of earth. The two men worked in a zigzag manner, always attacking a rock, no matter how large, whenever they could find one. They removed boulders from the mammoth trench that 10 men would find trouble in handling. The brothers seemed gifted with superhuman strength as well as energy, and they continued to dig long after they had struck water. For days they stood hip-deep in the pool, until their ragged trousers rotted away, leaving only the trunks. Whenever they removed a particularly large rock, they would find a witch, sometimes three or four, but after killing them, more of the creatures could be heard further down. It is averred by the best citizens of the locality that Nick Bischler worked for nearly 2 weeks without sleeping and without sitting down, the others building a fire by night, in the light of which he threw his relentless axe. The crowd kept increasing, until it was not unusual to see thousands of people on the surrounding hillsides, watching the labors of the poor wretches in the ravine, who did not even seem aware of the attention they were receiving. The Bischlers, in fact, became as great an attraction as a circus or a county fair to the people for miles around, and to none of the visitors did it occur that the miserable maniacs should be placed in confinement before they killed themselves. The story of the remarkable occurrences at Rocky Ravine finally reached North Vernon, however, and Mayor W. S. Prather, Attorney W. M. Fitzgerald, and Dr. E. W. Bance drove the seat of war one Sunday. On the next day, the Bischlers were prisoners on charges of lunacy. It was full time for such action. Poor Nick Bischler was nothing more than a living skeleton, being reduced from a weight of 160 pounds to half as much. He was so weak that but a few more strokes were left in his once powerful arm, and the enforced quiet after such excessive labors plunged him into a stupor of exhaustion, from which it seemed he would never be aroused. Sammy was but a little better, for he had done his utmost to bail the water out of the great trench, and might have succeeded had the perverse liquid not run back again as fast as he threw it out. Susan's wiry form seemed little injured by her long labor in open air. Nick was violently insane and was sent to the state asylum at Indianapolis, but was returned to the Jennings County Poor Farm, where Susan and Sammy already were. Nick did not remain. After a few hours' stay, he walked out of the infirmary unobserved and escaped into the tangled forests of the surrounding hills. And now comes the question, which is interesting the people residing in the vicinity of Rocky Ravine. Who is the wild man of the valley? Is it Nick Bischler in person, or his shade returned to the earth to finish the labor of driving the witches from the 40-acre farm? The latter theory is one that few intelligent people will entertain for a moment, and unless one disbelieves the stories of credible witnesses, is forced to the opinion that the poor maniac has sought once more the scene of his remarkable labors. How he subsists, and where he hides during the day, can only be imagined. The rocky fastness of this portion of Indiana would cover an army of men. However, poor Nick, if it is indeed he, seems to fear recapture almost as much as he feared witches, and only by night can his wild, grizzled figure be seen stealing toward the trench where the witches live. The mystery of the valley cannot long remain one, as the place seems to have a terrible fascination for the wild creature who visits it, and his capture is almost certain. In company with Mr. J.D. Fraser, the jovial station agent of North Vernon, who has taken a peculiar interest in the strange adventures of the witch diggers, your correspondent visited the county poor farm, where Susan and Sammy Bishler live. Susan was found in her own room, complaining of the rheumatism. "It is the vicious," she said in a commonplace tone. "So they still bother you?" "Oh, yes, yes. They come in all the time, and I can't get rid of them. Nix runned away."
"Where to, Susie?"
"Back to the old place. He's ticking tear again, I think."
"Why do you think so?"
"Oh, he didn't kill them all. And when he runned away, he said he was coming back."
Outside of her superstition, old Susan is very intelligent, and she told the history of her family in a very entertaining manner. Sammy was seen too, but after offering to shake hands with a visitor, he changed his mind and drew back to strike him.
"Witch, witch," he shouted. "He thinks you're a witch," remarked Superintendent McManaman. "He thinks you're a witch," repeated Sammy, parrot-like and still gazing at the newcomer with frightened eyes.
The farm where the witch diggers lived is now occupied by Charles Hale, a prosperous farmer, who is the father of Professor Tice's manager. The old shanty where the Bishlers first saw their sinister enemies retained the reputation of being haunted, given it by its owners, until very recently, when one night it went up in flames and smoke. Nothing remains as evidence of the events recorded above, except the mighty trench and rocky ravine, the broken boulders, and the other debris incident to the search for the witches. From The Times, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, August 21st, 1892.
Into these stories, I want to try to prove as much as possible that they're true. I mean, it's hard to prove
that the people were real. You want to make sure,
right? Yeah, so that's where you start.
And with this one, it's so strange. It's easy to think that it never happened, that it's unreal, but it is in fact true. It really happened,
as best as we can tell.
Yes,
the people were real. We know that much. So the Bishlers. My wife did the genealogy on them. She's a pretty...
Awesome.
Yeah, she's pretty good at that. She gets it genetically from her father and her grandfather. We're also pretty hardcore genealogists. So she helped me track the Bishlers down and find some information on them. What they say in the article is absolutely true with the number of children. Sammy's real name might have been Henry. There's a note in the census of a Henry Bishler, okay, and no mention of Sammy. I think they mentioned that he was dark-complected even, okay, and I think they mentioned that in the article as well. That he,
okay.
So his real name might have been Henry. Maybe Sammy was a nickname.
Yeah.
Who knows? Other than that, all the information seems dead on that they mentioned in the article, except that, from what we can tell, all three of the brothers that went to the Civil War
were in the same regiment.
Same regiment, unless Nick was maybe transferred at some point away, and that's not in the records that we found.
So here we end up having, we have four brothers, one sister, but the brothers in the war, one died, and then there's an interesting story about the other brother.
Yeah, John was a prisoner of war. He fought for the Union, so he would have been a prisoner in one of the southern prison camps. And he died on a very famous maritime tragedy. It was actually the biggest maritime tragedy in the history of the United States.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The Sultana explosion. It was a steamship that blew up, I think it was on the Mississippi, April 27th, 1865. and it was filled with thousands of POW, well, released POWs.
It was overfilled. There were more people than were supposed to be on it, correct?
Many more. Yeah. Many, many more people.
Then it exploded.
They were warned about it. The captain had made some kind of deal with the colonel to get all these prisoners home or something. He took a bribe. Or the colonel took a bribe. The Sultana story is really, really interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
It's really worth looking into. We could probably do an episode on that, and we might.
Yeah, we very well might.
So it exploded April 27th, 1865. In the article, they say he drowned. They don't mention that he drowned because the Sultana exploded.
Yeah. And what I think about that is when you ask people how they don't want to die, usually fire and drowning come up, and that gentleman and many other were faced with either dying by fire or by water.
Yeah, and he could have burned and then drowned, for all we know. I mean, it's a horrible story. So you start out with this horrible family history going into it. The Civil War wasn't a pretty war anyway.
Yeah.
So Nick is the only of the three brothers that went to war who's coming home.
And I can imagine he was not very well. He's seen some things, and he was probably a bit shaken, though the article doesn't say anything necessarily about his condition on returning home.
It doesn't, but he does seem to keep to himself.
Yeah.
And he moves the family from Ohio to Indiana.
And that's where the strangeness begins.
It does. So there's these elements that pop up that I recognized in the Witch Digger story that made me look at it as a Bigfoot thing. In other words, they're talking about human-headed monkeys in the article. They're talking about them coming through.
They're supposedly what started this, yeah.
So these old articles, they didn't have Bigfoot. It wasn't a name back then. They called them wild men.
Yeah.
They didn't have a lot of name for these. I think maybe the Bishlers were calling them witches.
Yeah.
So these creatures, I'm assuming they're Bigfoots, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked in the area. I just thought, out of curiosity, I shift my research from Pennsylvania to Indiana for a bit. And I looked up wild men in the area and gorillas.
Mm-hmm.
This is the late 1800s. Mostly, you look for wild men. That's mostly what they called these creatures. They didn't have a real name for them. In the vocabulary. If you're not familiar with a gorilla at this point, you know.
Yeah, as we said in episode 3, Bigfoot didn't come around until the 50s, I believe it was.
Yeah,
right?
Like 50s, 60s, really didn't come into common use, probably to the 70s. But the mountain gorilla wasn't known to the West until really the late 1800s. Most people wouldn't have had it as a vocabulary word. So what do you call a hairy thing that walks on two legs that you see? You call it a wild man. And I
makes
guess
sense.
The attitude of a lot of these old articles, and again, for my book, I'm just neck deep in this stuff. So there's this sort of undercurrent that when a man abandons society, turns his back on society and goes off to live in the woods, somehow he grows hair like an animal.
Yes.
And they'll mention like Darwin sometimes.
Yeah, evolution doesn't take a very long time, apparently. You go out in the woods for one day and you grow hair all over your body.
Yeah, it's a matter of just turning your back on society and you'll start to grow hair. That was kind of the attitude and belief of a lot of people, I think, back then. So then the mountain gorilla becomes known because they were bringing him over from circuses for zoos, and they were taking pictures of them that were appearing in newspapers, so people would see him traveling around sometimes, or they'd see pictures of him in the newspaper. So now they had something to call it. Now they said, oh, it's a gorilla. I saw a gorilla in the woods. So you find these gorilla articles too. So I looked around for wild men and gorillas in Indiana around the same time as the Witch Diggers article. And interestingly enough, very close by, I found these articles.
A Hoosier gorilla. Recent discoveries made in a cave in Jennings County. Vernon, April 3rd. This is one of the oldest towns in Indiana and is surrounded by rock-ribbed hills.
Years ago, a subterranean cavern was reported to have been discovered by a man residing here named Barnes, which he claimed to have explored for a short distance, discovering a large, tall form, somewhat resembling a human, but appearing to be naked and covered with a tuft or growth of hair. Barnes was so frightened that he fled from the presence of the image, whatever it was, and was so ridiculed when he told his story that he never revealed the secret of the location of his cave. The story has now been revived by a startling discovery made yesterday by Alexander Shepherd, a real estate dealer, who was showing a farm to a prospective purchaser. Going up a deep ravine, whose bed is covered with stone for a long distance, they accidentally discovered a small entrance or hole that went underneath a large hill. Procuring a lantern from a neighbor, they entered the opening with some difficulty, and soon found themselves inside a large and lofty cavern, the rooms glittering with stalagmites and stalactites, like other caverns of its character abounding in southern Indiana. After passing through numerous chambers, each more elaborate and beautiful than the one just gone through, they stopped to gaze on the magnificent spectacle that greeted them on every hand. But suddenly their admiration turned to horror, and their hair stood on end, as they discovered only a few feet from them the huge form of what seemed to be a gorilla, or some being resembling a wild man, naked and covered apparently with a rough coat of brown hair. After gazing on the intruders for a moment, it gave a low, guttural snort and went ambling off into the deep, impenetrable darkness of the cavern. It appeared to be over 6 feet in height. After this strange being disappeared, the explorers turned to the right and discovered what appeared to be a storeroom, which was found to contain piles of potatoes, corn and wheat, and bones of fowls, and in another room adjoining this one was found numerous bones dry with age. For a long time, almost nightly, strange noises have been heard in the locality of the deep wood surrounding this subterranean cavern, and all attempts to fathom the mystery proved a failure. No one could ever discover the source of the noise, and dogs refused to investigate it. Farmers in the locality were losing their products almost nightly, and no one knew where they went. It seemed that in making its nightly incursions, it always followed the stony pathway of the stream leading to the cavern, and this accounted for failure to trace him to his hiding place. Years ago, a wild man, or similar personage, inhabited Trimble County, Kentucky, and later Jefferson County, this state, adjoining this, Jennings County, and for some years now, no trace of him has been known. This being is believed to be the same. A large party is being organized to explore the labyrinth of the mysterious cavern and discover the character of its occupant. The Indiana State Sentinel, Indianapolis, Indiana, April 8th, 1891. Two honest, sober citizens of Marion have seen a wild man near that place. Angola Herald, Angola, Indiana, September 6, 1893.
Tonight we're talking with Joshua Cutchin. Joshua, you've got, what, two books out?
Yeah, I do. Both three anomalous books. A Trojan Feast, which is about the sort of the role of food in anomalous encounters, and The Brimstone Deceit, which looks at the commonalities of scent in a lot of these 14 events.
Huh. And we're not going to talk to you about either of those tonight.
I know, it's refreshing.
But that is very interesting.
I'm excited to not talk about it, yeah.
But we will have to have you back on at some point and dig into the taste and smell of the paranormal with you.
Yeah, and where can you get those?
They're available through Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
But tonight we're talking about The Witch Diggers, which is an article I threw your way. Basically, just because I heard you talking about a certain episode of Sasquatch Chronicles on Where Did the Road Go? I found some commonalities there, and I thought, well, I'm gonna bring Joshua on and talk to him about that.
Well, this really did tickle my Forty and Funnybone, because, you know, a lot of what I like to see is, and I think we're kindred spirits in this sense, I like to see how these sort of topics overlap and overlay and intersect. And this particular account has it's sort of a grab bag of things, but with this really interesting core of that what looks like, you know, sort of a Sasquatch report surrounded by all this real strangeness.
To me, like, the really interesting thing is and I did ask Wes to come on from Sasquatch Chronicles, but
never got back.
He never got back to me. He's talked about this case several times, and you did on Soraya's show, like I said. Basically, this is a modern account of these two brothers who had these creatures that were coming up around their house.
In Tennessee.
And they had a psychic medium come on, and she told the brothers that they were demons or somehow demonic. They were coming from the earth.
Yeah, they were coming from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they mentioned this weird sort of woman that was walking around that they kept seeing.
That's the part that really intrigues me.
Yeah, it's just, I've always said that with these sort of phenomena, it really does behoove us to take note of the sort of company they keep, you know? The fact that Aleister Crowley set up his home on the shores of Loch Ness, where there's supposedly this Loch Ness monster, I find interesting. And similarly, when you have an account like this particular one, two guys who, if I recall the account correctly, were very much on the flesh and blood Sasquatch train. And then, you know, they heard this and they were like, I don't know about that. And then, as you know, they sort of started seeing more things and seeing more unexplainable things. They really started to come around to the idea, well, maybe there is something here, for lack of a better term, demonic. Now, of course, to clarify, I mean, if you look at the way that term has been used over the past couple of millennia, it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing that it means now.
Yeah, but that's my thing. Like the, when we start talking about demonic stuff, I always say, let's be really careful, because I think, for the most part, our concept of demons is probably very childlike.
Yeah, I think it really does stem from, you know, I'm a Christian myself, but I think it stems from this really tiresome. This tiresome dichotomy that's been set up, this false dichotomy where if things aren't of God, they must be of the devil. And, you know, I think it's much more likely to me to sort of view these things in terms of an ecosystem. I mean, you know, there are things that are overtly malign and things that are, you know, overtly benevolent. But I think there's a lot of stuff that's just trying to make its own way in the world and, you know, can go one way or the other. And I think that, you know, it's something that doesn't get talked about a lot, but the whole Sasquatch thing plugs into fairy folklore really well. And I know that this isn't a surprise to anybody who follows my work that I'm interested in the fairy angle on it. But it really does plug in to, like, this idea of, like, a forest poltergeist or, you know, sort of a woodland elemental spirit in a way that I think that is really underappreciated in discourse nowadays.
I absolutely agree. In fact, when we were on Soraya's show together, you mentioned that so much of this Bigfoot activity in the woods, you know, throwing rocks and weird noises and so forth, just correspond with poltergeist activity. It's a little light went off in my head, like, oh yeah, you know.
Yeah, and you know, the rocks will be warm to the touch, which is a very poltergeist thing. Now, you could argue that, you know, Bigfoot was keeping it under his arm or something, I guess. That could be the possibility, too. But, you know, disembodied voices, unpleasant smells, rappings, you know, several things which we have in this particular story. I mean, that was my first thought, is that they made the connection for one of the witnesses seeing this shaggy wild man in the woods, and they said that was, you know, that there was a succession of blows that was being heard, and before they even revealed that it was, you know, possibly some sort of digging tool, my first thought went to wood knocks. I mean, like, that's what you always hear, is, you know, this idea of this knocking sound in the forest. And of course, it's immediately followed up by a stone flying through the air. So all these things that smell squatchy. And, you know, even, again, look at the company that these things keep. Even if it is, you know, in this case, a flesh and blood Sasquatch. It's chosen an awfully strange place to be, given the history of the family in that area, if everything is to be, you know, believed.
Yeah, there's just an odd, it's an odd menu to choose there.
It's a very high strange mouth feel, I think, is in terms of the phrasing that I would probably use.
What do you make of, again, in both the Sasquatch Chronicles thing and this, you had this weird woman creeping around, you know, with the creatures.
Well,
speaking of strange company, you know.
and I don't want to be like, I've been on the fairy train for so long. I feel like if you're too embedded in a certain paradigm and you're not changing the way that you think in these sort of topics, then it's probably not a good thing. But I've been so persuaded by some of the stuff that I've found out about, you know, the way that the fairy folklore, whatever it's describing, if it really is fairies or if it's something, you know, of a different variety, whatever that's describing is so compellingly connective to all this. And, you know, one thing that's been that's an interesting connection that a lot of people haven't really put together that often is this idea of, you know, the fairy queen. If you look at sort of fairy folklore as a whole, you'll find oftentimes that there are these shorter fae folk who are being supervised by a taller fairy queen. And you see the exact same motif in the abduction experience, where sometimes there's literally a woman, but oftentimes just a taller gray alien, you know, standing and supervising these shorter grays, oftentimes, you know, holding a wand in both cases. So, you know, I wonder if perhaps there isn't some sort of supervisory feminine spirit. You know, I'm reminded of you know, Terrence McKenna would say the mother goddess, or, you know, we would make some sort of reference to that. But I think that there is a history of qualifying, if we're going to sort of get really esoteric, deep in the weeds here, there is a strong tradition worldwide of characterizing nature as feminine, you know, Gaia, Mother Earth, that sort of thing, Mother Ayahuasca. And I wonder if perhaps, you know, there isn't some sort of element that's being manifested in that way here. That's the most sense that I can make out of it.
It sounds as logical as anything to me. It certainly is logical as some sort of witch that's summoning these hairy things.
What I see is with the archetype thing, and there's the visions of Mary, and then the feminine kind of overseer all throughout the world, and every culture's got different things. But what intrigues me about this is it's almost the exact same description for both situations of the old white. Is it the, like, she's all kind of white? She's got the pale complexion and long face. It's almost identical. I almost feel like these brothers may have heard that story and incorporated it because it's so identical in these two particular situations.
Oh yeah, I mean it's very specific. Now I can't recall. Do you remember where those brothers were from in the modern encounter?
It was Tennessee, I believe.
Okay, it's not too far geographically removed.
No,
there was a couple people who jumped in, I think, in the Sasquatch Chronicles forum and started listing. Like, oh, I saw, you know, a weird-looking woman in conjunction with a Sasquatch sighting or something as well. So it appears to be one of these things that happens that people just don't note that much. I'm wondering if it's like I always bring up UFOs and Sasquatch, how, you know, a lot of your Sasquatch researchers throw out the UFOs, you know, when they happen at the same time. Out the window goes the UFOs, and they'll tell you all day about the Sasquatch thing.
Because our subject isn't the crazy subject. It's when our people say that they saw Bigfoot, well, they're you know, telling the truth. But when those people say that they saw a flying saucer, well, they're crazy. I mean, that's part of the reason. And there is an attitude that I feel like is thawing a bit. But there has historically been this attitude that if people report anything high strange in a Bigfoot encounter, that, you know, their entire encounter should be discredited. But it happens too often. And you'll hear people say, well, it doesn't happen in most cases. Well, yeah, most cases are, you know, a roadside crossing, although I think that there's something sort of anomalous about the timing of those events usually. But there is just enough weird. It's like the UFO thing. Like, maybe a lot of those cases that you see don't have that high strangeness component, but if you start like sort of if you start sort of digging around the edges of that person's life a little bit, you'll start to see these other motifs that come up, and it's just it's that aspect of it I think is pretty darn consistent.
You know, if you take a roadside crossing, these are usually so brief. But if you have people who have like ongoing contact, like these brothers, for instance, and, or the witch diggers family in the article, you almost always start getting really, really weird stuff in conjunction. Just, you know, not just stuff that'll make you start going, is this just an ape? You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes I wonder if the time, if there are certain growing pains that esoteric subjects go through. And if you take like an arbitrary a beginning point for, you know, the ologies, like, okay, so I know that people were into cryptids well before the Patterson-Gimlin footage, but if you look at the Patterson-Gimlin event, or like the Wallace tracks rather, as sort of a watershed moment, I wonder if perhaps you can't see the sort of through line where certain disciplines, these certain fringe disciplines, evolve and they eventually start to become more accepting of alternative ideas, or if there isn't, like, everybody starts out with this nuts and bolts idea and then slowly but surely it becomes a little bit more accepting of other fringier ideas. And I guess that's sort of, you know, I guess that is what one would expect, because you're trying to start with the most parsimonious and the most logical starting point, explanation rather, before, you know, exhausting all those options and saying, well, maybe it's something really weird. But sometimes I wonder if there isn't like this sort of growing pains that every 14 discipline has to go through before they can eventually start saying, okay, yeah, this is getting weird. There's some stuff here that we can't quite nail down.
I can see that. I, you know, when you talk about the nuts and bolts UFO people, you know, and that's started to go away, you know, gradually. So hopefully the strict ape in the woods, Bigfoot people can soften on that. And I always have to give this caveat. I do want to say, I believe people are seeing something, and I believe something's leaving hair and footprints and scat behind. I just don't think it's as an ape in the woods. That's all I'm saying.
You know, sometimes I think, you know, in this particular example, you're talking about repeat people or like habituators, like repeaters, UFO repeaters, as they used to be called derogatorily, used to be made fun of all the time. People who would see UFOs, you know, time and again. Now it's become something that really makes people sit up and say, oh, well, if you've seen it this many times, you probably have some sort of ongoing contact experience. So that attitude has completely changed. And I think that you're starting to see attitudes like that completely sort of shift in the Bigfoot, you know, realm as well. But, you know, to sort of build off of what you just said, there is a physical component, and I would even in the case of Bigfoot say a physical, like biological component to these experiences, just as there is a physical component that interacts with the physical world in UFO experiences. But I think that there's something supplemental grafted onto that, and you know, sometimes I wonder if there isn't some sort of phenomena that is saying, that is using sort of the pageantry of primates, just as the UFO phenomena uses the pageantry and the imagery of, you know, our popular culture and our sci-fi, to sort of get to us, to sort of bridge that gap between whatever it is and whatever its motives are, and, you know, and human beings.
I could totally see that. I could totally see that.
What's easiest to grasp? We have to start somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that was in common between both the Sasquatch Chronicles account and this was the psychic medium told the brothers in the Sasquatch Chronicles account that the creatures were coming out of the ground. And the major part of the Witch Diggers article has to do with them, you know, digging into the ground to find these supposed witches.
Right.
So, and I'm guessing that ties right in with fairy lore.
I mean, yes. I mean, you kind of have to wonder, maybe the family actually failed, and, you know, the Bishlers actually failed, and the witches did come up, and the witches are what Sasquatch looks like. I mean, they wouldn't. There's a precedent for that. I mean, if you look at the Minerva Monster events of Ohio, people described the Sasquatch that they saw was this big, tall, hairy witch, is what they said. But you know, in any case, there is a sort of a precedent for like hairy witches, as it were. So sometimes I wonder if, like, you know, the family didn't fail and the witches, you know, popped out and they just look like these, you know, axe wielding Sasquatch. But you're right. There is a strong, again, strong fae folk component. I mean, really a strong everything component. I mean, so you've got this idea of these witches living underground. Some people have proposed, even though there's not a lot of good evidence, some people have proposed that perhaps Sasquatch resides in caves underground. You have persistent rumors of military bases underground and, you know, military alien joint bases underground. You have the Shaver mysteries. We talked about the Darrows and the Taros. You had the fae folk who lived in fairy mounds, who would literally, you know, go underground to their dwelling. You know, where do we bury people? Where do ghosts come from? Underground. And you can even look at this metaphor as continuing. I mean, you know, if you look at lake monsters, it's still this motif of submersion. So, you know, I think someone like, if you are familiar with the work of Patrick Harper, he would say that this was, you know, an expression of, you know, sort of the Jungian shadow, you know, the subconscious sort of, you know, being occluded to us. Not that he thinks that there isn't some sort of objective phenomena going on, but you know, I think that that's such a beautiful and sort of elegant metaphor for the way that these things react. And you know, I like the idea that, you know, there's that the presence of these things underground might not be literal and is more trying to tell us something about these presences themselves, about how they interact with us and about maybe even where they come from, coming from some sort of collective unconscious. But yeah, the underground slash submersion slash occluded sort of metaphor is very persistent. I mean, things are always just out of touch on the other side, you know, beyond the forest's edge, beyond the Earth's atmosphere. This is where, you know, these monsters lurk, and I think that you know, this is another good example of people folding in that motif.
I'm very much on that train. I'm reading Patrick Harper's Daemonic Reality right now.
Oh, it's so good! It's so good.
And I'm completely on the Jungian archetype train as far as these things go.
Yeah, and you know, people get upset when you say something like that, which isn't a good attitude to have if you're interested in these things, because if you really, you know, if you're really looking for the truth, you don't really have a dog in the fight. But B, I think that they overlook like how they think that it means that it's all, you know, in your head. No, I mean, it means that to the contrary, it almost means that anything in your head is real to some
extent.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Which I find just as, I mean, I find that it opens up even more possibilities than any other, you know, sort of objective, siloed, here are the Bigfoot, here are the Sasquatch, here are the Bigfoot, here are the aliens, here's the, you know, the lake monster, here's the this, here's the that. I think that's, yeah, I mean, it's not a particularly popular view, but it's like top six theories for me, probably.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I have, you know, I kind of extend it into the folks that leave, you know, apples for Sasquatch in the woods, say, it's an offering. You know, you take this back to the old days, you know, where people would leave out, and again, we're talking about food for the fairies, or
it's,
you know, it's just
it's
go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No.
I was just gonna say, no, it grafts on so surprisingly well, you know, and if you look at sort of what happens in both those cases, if you forgot to leave food out for your pixies, if you forgot to, you know, put beer in the corner, found, you know, the keystone of your house where you have a hole where you used to put beer for the brownies, they would wreck your life. They'd wreck your life. They'd wreck your livestock. And if you look at accounts where, if people are to be believed, they have left stuff out for Sasquatch, apples and whatnot, or even, you know, even more elaborate offerings. Well, if something happens and they stop that, the Sasquatch tend to get really angry and they wreck your household and they kill your livestock, if people are to be believed. And you know what? Even if those stories aren't true, I find them compelling because I refuse to believe that some of these people are that well versed in fairy folklore. It almost says that the people, you know, even when people make stuff up, they're tapping into this thing that's out there that has to have some sort of objective truth, even if it's just the way that mankind explains forces beyond their control in this reality.
Yeah, there's something that, I mean, this commonality that reaches across, and I think this has become the overarching theme of our podcast, and it started just because we'd find ghost stories where we found Sasquatch sightings, where we find UFO sightings again and again and again. As we're putting pins on the map, it doesn't, you know, we got a blue pin for a ghost and a red one for a Sasquatch and a green one for a UFO. They're going in the same place. And after a while, we start going, huh. You know, there seems to be something to this. My issue, it's not even an issue because, I mean, it's, you know, I'm a member of several different Bigfoot groups on let's just take on Facebook for an example. And some of them are strict flesh and blood groups. They don't want to hear any other theory. They want nothing, you know, no woo, as they call it, no woo allowed. To people like that, I just, and it's, again, it's why I say again and again, I absolutely believe something's leaving footprints and hair behind. It's not, but to try to marry these concepts, you know, to someone who either doesn't believe at all or believes it's an ape in the woods, it's just so difficult to try to get it across to them. Like, I'm not fighting with you on the physicality of this thing. I'm just saying there's more to it, and there's these other elements that weave into these other paranormal things so well.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons that I have an essay that's coming out in a compilation of ufology essays this May that is about this. But this is one of those reasons why I double down on psi phenomena. And I get disheartened when someone is interested in these subjects and haven't availed themselves of how good the psi phenomena research is out there, how some of it's been peer reviewed. You know, we're dealing with some amazing research that is just tearing down this materialist idea that we, you know, exist in this meaningless universe that, you know, where the fundamental quality of everything is matter. It's just, you know, atoms. It's great research, and it's just getting better by the year. And you give a generation or two of these, you know, this old guard scientific establishment to die off, and this is going to be the rule of the day. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that I don't need to. Doesn't mean that I don't need to go to the bathroom and I don't need to sleep. You know, well, what it does mean is that there's another component that is completely intangible that can interact with this, you know, with the physical. Not that there is no physical world. It's just that the physical and the non-physical can interact.
To me, they can't be separated. So
yeah, well, yeah, exactly. It bugs me because, you know, you'll have these same people who are talking about, well, you know, no woo stories, defend vociferously the people who are, you know, ridiculed about seeing Bigfoot and, you know, hearing strange talking in the woods. Oh, that must be Bigfoot, this and that and the other. But then they'll ridicule someone who has like an extra little strange component. It just seems so hypocritical.
Yeah, it gets pulled out immediately. And it doesn't fit their parameters. Gets ruled out.
And if you're going to keep on walking back what people see, you might as well walk it all the way back to misidentification. You might as well walk it all the way back to people being, to every witness being out of their mind, being every witness hallucinating. You know, if you say that every UFO, or if you say that, if you throw out some of these weird UFO encounters, well, then you might as well say that everybody just saw Venus. You know, it gets to that point. You know, at some point you have to believe what witnesses are saying.
Yeah, and it's a point I always make. If you're going to believe person A saw an 8-foot tall ape in the woods, and you're going to throw out the fact that person B saw a blue light around the corner, you know, at the same time, roughly the same time, roughly the same place, you're missing part of the puzzle somehow.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people say, well, they're just two weird things that happen. You don't know that they're related. Yeah, but you don't know that they're not related, yeah. And you have to note them at least, you know.
Yeah, okay, so let's take the idea that Bigfoot is flesh and blood. Well, that means that where it lives, in terms, you know, ecosystemically, must be appropriate, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to look at, you know, if that's the case from a physicalist standpoint, if there are these other strange phenomena associated with that particular area, then at the very least, that phenomena finds this particular environment suitable, which, you know, is the very least that I think you can say about it.
Yeah. And I mean, just not to note it at all seems to me it's just willfully ignorant.
Well, and let's admit it's getting better. Like it is. And I think, you know, kudos, you know, on the off chance that Wes is listening, you know, kudos to you, man, for opening up about this, some of this stuff, because the tenor of Sasquatch Chronicles has changed markedly in the past few years.
It has, and he's, you know, and he'll actually cover stuff about lights in the woods. He's not going so far as to say, you know, it's related, but he's doing stuff on lights in the woods. He's doing some of these weirder topics. So yeah, absolutely. I agree.
I would love to talk to him, because every now and then you get these little hints at the edges of some of these stories that people tell that are, If you know enough, if you have a broad enough Fortean foundation, mean a lot more, I think, than, you know, some of these details that people have. Like, you know, for example, the fact that people always talk about, you know, well, it sounded like a giant owl. And, oh, well, that must have been Sasquatch. Well, no, there's plenty of weirdness associated with owls that we can talk about. Like, you know, that's a motif in and of itself. So, I mean, they're, you know, lurking at the edge of all these stories, even the straightforward ones, are these little details that if you are looking at it, if you stand in the back of the room and look at the whole painting, it's a lot curiouser than you'd expect. Now, there is one aspect of this particular, you know, the Bischler family case that were the, you know, the associated wild men with the area that we haven't really talked about, which is the, you know, the fact that this initial wild man sighting was carrying an axe, right?
Yeah.
It was carrying an axe, and then it dropped down onto four legs and ran with the axe somehow.
I think it's another detail that makes it seem less and less like a flesh and blood Bigfoot. I mean, you know, maybe it's conceivable that a Sasquatch would grab an axe and use it or know how to use it, but that doesn't feel right, does it?
No, it's an odd little detail. Yeah, I thought, you know, maybe it was just a misidentification, and at first I thought, well, maybe they saw eye shine and they thought something was glinting off, you know, an axe.
But then they
specifically mentioned the eye shine, I think, like in the next paragraph, and the axe again.
But they and they really associated the axe with Nick, so it almost seemed inseparable. And to me, it tied in Nick being the wild man. Maybe that was the obvious thing. I don't know. But they did associate Nick with the axe. He was the one using the axe to furiously dig, you know, for these witches.
Yeah, that's interesting too. You know, what the axe detail really reminds me of is there are plenty of cases that you'll find where, well, not plenty, but there are more than you'd expect of cases where you will find, you know, a Bigfoot wearing a red flannel shirt, or, you know, a Bigfoot wearing some sort of, you know, some sort of, you know, old, you know, faded jeans.
Yeah. I used to hate those when I was a kid. I remember reading Bigfoot books as a kid, and you come across these reports of Bigfoot, and I hated that. And now, as you know, when I get in, now that I'm into the weirder aspects of it, I love those reports. Those are so interesting.
It makes me think of Bruce Banner, the Incredible Hulk walking around with Bruce Banner.
Exactly. Yes. So what is that? I mean, it's either a were-squatch, which is, you know, that's multiplying unnecessarily if there ever was a definition, or you know, or Sasquatch is taking people's clothing, which, it's just, it doesn't make sense for 100 different reasons, or it's something just Or it's, you know, option C, whatever that is. And right now, it's option C. Sounds good to me.
And so, the ditch has been dug. Episode 4 of Strange Familiars. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you want to help, again, go to patreon.com/strangefamiliars. We could definitely use the help. Share us around on social media. Thanks for listening. And we'd like to thank Joshua Cutchin for coming on the show today. He was a great addition.
Yeah, that was a real pleasure. I mean, I was real nervous going into that. It was my first attempt at Skyping. Joshua made it very easy. He was very well-spoken. It was a great conversation. I had a really good time with that. And like I said, it was just a real pleasure. So thank you, Joshua. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, LLC, music, art, podcast, books, and more. DarkHollerArts.com.
Intro and background music by Stone Breath, which is our band. Go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com for more.
Our newsreader for this episode was Sarada. Thank you.
Waits here for thee amongst